dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm fond of pointing out that a man who has actual intelligence credentials in his background is one of our great resources on matters involving border and interior immigration policies and insecurity. His name is Todd Bensman. He is the author of a terrific new book called America's Covert Border War. He is also a senior national security fellow for a terrific organization, the Center for Immigration Studies, and always a welcome guest here. Todd Bensman, thanks for joining us once again.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, Todd, I think we always need to do a little bit of level setting with you. Each time we talk, I think it's worse than it was before. But give us your current read, if you would, on the state of what I think you agree is best described now as an invasion of our country across our southern border.
Well, the numbers tell the story. We have the June numbers are fresh out, apprehension numbers showing just a hair at 188,000. And that's going to be between ports of entry and at ports of entry. And these are historic highs. It's a clear indication that something is terribly awry at the border. We haven't seen any kind of numbers like this in 20, 25 years. So that's a good way to understand what's happening. But then within that flow, you have an increasing share of people coming from all over the world, from Africa and Asia and the Middle East and elsewhere in South America, Haiti, Cuba. Really, the entire world is on the march to the American border, and it's now where it once was about 3 or 4% of the total. It's now 26% of the total apprehensions at the border, and climbing fast.
And then there are the myriad numbers, and one can only estimate what they might be, of getaways, as they say. Todd, what's your current reading on what the actual amount would be if you were to factor in the people who are not apprehended, but nonetheless get into the country?
Yeah, that's a disturbing number. There are estimates out there that in the month of June, the number was 60,000. So you could tack that on. I mean, we're well over 200,000, in the low 200,000 range when you factor in the gotaways. Those are an underestimate typically. They reflect footprints in the sand in areas where nobody got caught, or a video camera from helicopters, or still cameras on the ground, and they get reported back to headquarters and kind of tallied and estimated. But we're looking at, typically, 40,000, 50,000 May, 60,000 June. And the reason why we're having increasing numbers of gotaways is because of a policy, it's a Biden policy of pushing back single adult males into Mexico for the pandemic called Title 42. When single males are caught, they get sent back, but there are no consequences. So it doesn't a catch and release back to Mexico is not tallied as a criminal entry or something that would stack against that migrant and deter for the next time. So they keep trying again and again and again, tying up border resources until they actually get through. The reason they keep trying again is because they're going to get through eventually. And those are the gotaways.
You know, speaking of the Biden policies, one of the things that I've just seen coming across the wire is that the Biden administration has decided, in the face of this disastrous invasion, that they're going to revert, I guess, to something akin to what was used during the Trump administration in terms of a fast-track deportation procedure called expedited removal for families that will not be given an immigration judge hearing. This is somewhat stunning, and I hope, A, it's true, and B, that it evidences a decision on the part of this administration to try to address, at least in part, the Biden effect, as I think you've called it, Todd Bensman, that has induced so many people to come here. It would only address it in part, of course. And unless and until you do something about these vast numbers of individual young males, typically, that are coming across as well, we're not going to see any appreciable diminution of these numbers, I assume. Would you agree?
Well, I haven't studied the plan for expedited removals yet, but if that is in fact what they're planning to do, that's a positive step. That's a good. That means that they're clearly seeing political ramifications for 2022 and beyond. This is, the polling numbers are just appalling for the Democrats on this whole issue. In fact, it's their Achilles heel. Expedited removal, though, is it's one thing to have that on the books, but it's another thing to actually track these people down and actually physically remove them, especially when you've completely gutted ICE and removed their key function of the ERO, the deportation officer corps. So they'll have to
fix and the funding well. For it as well has been evaporated, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical about the whole thing, but I've been maybe they mean business, because there are real political problems with what they've done at the border. It's completely obvious to the American public what they've done.
Yeah, but Todd, unfortunately, I guess it's a race against the clock, because on the one hand, the reason they've done this, as best I can tell, is because the Biden team thinks that it will benefit them electorally. And so maybe it's a question of, will it go negatively before the cumulative effect of these people they intend to have become Democratic voters in large numbers can kick in?
Yeah, well, you know, when you actually take into account the tens of thousands of family units that are just pouring in, they've allowed to just pour in right to processing, straight from river to processing, and then buses.
And from processing directly into what?
Buses.
Yeah, you know, buses and planes.
And planes. I call it catch and bus.
Right.
You know, look, they're going to have people.
And just to finish that thought, Todd, where do they go on those buses or planes?
I mean, I've counted about 14 different states. There are probably far more than that. But that's just from my own on the ground reporting, where I ask the immigrants, where are you going? And they tell me, and I'll scribble it down. But they're going to all corners of the country. Haitians and Cubans are all heading to Florida. Lots of them to Florida. Central Americans going all over the country. And even if somebody gets an order to be removed or something like that for expedited removal, there are appeals. There are ways to get around that. And you can disappear and run and hide too. You can have to track people down with their children in front of TV cameras. And I don't know.
Even if you have the resources to do that, it's problematic. But Todd, just on that point, have you given any thought to, or has your research given you any indication that some of these people, you mentioned Florida as a case in point, are being moved in the expectation that it can actually affect the electorate in certain red states?
Yeah, I think about this, the question of loading Democratic precincts with potential voters, but nothing like that's going to happen in the immediate future, short of mass voter fraud or something. These folks are not eligible to vote but not to say that they can't go find ways to cast votes anyway. But
and there is a certain evidence of voter fraud taking place, so I think that that can't be discounted altogether. But hey, listen, before we go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to say that there's also speculation that the Biden administration is really messaging hard against Cuban vote people coming in, because Cubans tend to vote Republican. So, I mean, it sounds plausible to me, but, you know, I don't really know how those Cubans are going to be voting anything without fraud.
Well, but again, I think that has to be expected. Let me ask you about another aspect of this, Todd, that I know you've been warning about, but I think is becoming more and more of a problem for Americans who are now confronting the prospect of being told they have to get back into their masks, they have to get back into their houses, they have to go back into, you know, sort of the kind of unbelievably, well, I think totalitarian is not too strong a term for it, lockdowns, because the Delta strain of the virus that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, unleashed on us is now causing us all kinds of problems. And yet, most of the people who are making these demands of the rest of us are indifferent to, if not actually championing, this infusion of vast numbers of people, many of them either with the Delta strain or unprotected against it, to be pushed out, as you say, Todd, all over the country. It's hard to imagine a more effective spreader program than what is underway. And yet there's this policy disconnect, it would seem, on the part of the administration itself and some of its advocates on Capitol Hill and in the media.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much of a disconnect that is so much as rank hypocrisy. It's just really obvious what's going on there. You know, your Republican COVID is terrible, and, you know, poor immigrant Democratic voter, future Democratic voter COVID is perfectly fine for import. It's just absurd. But the fact of the matter is that many of the people who are crossing the border right now are coming from countries where the COVID is not under control at all. The vaccinations in these countries are low compared to most, like, you know, think Haiti, think Cuba, think Central America, compared to, you know, our country and what we've done. And the folks that are coming in and being allowed onto buses, are many of them are being given COVID tests, but it's the rapid kind, which are notorious for being not accurate. And then they're being put on buses, but a lot of them are not getting tested. When I interview them, some say that they were tested and others say that they didn't get tested. But between the time they cross the river and get on the buses, they are exposing all of our Border Patrol agents. And hopefully most of them are vaccinated, but there are about 30 Border Patrol or CBP personnel who have died of COVID. Many of those instance, and there are about 30 or 40 that are sick right now. And so, you know, those guys are frontline guys are being exposed to this. And so is everybody on the bus and everybody who, on the airplanes and in the military bases where they're now moving them through and holding children and everybody. It's just spreading through the country.
What could possibly go wrong? Yeah, no question. Hey, listen, before we run out of time, I just wanted to ask you about one other outrage of the Biden policies. And again, you have in your terrific on-the-ground reporting on what's happening at the border, I think called attention to the holes in the border wall that have now been left, it would seem, at least for the time being, open to the invaders. We're now being told, Todd Bensman, that the United States taxpayers are out about $2 billion being paid to contractors not to build the wall. That is to say, to, you know, sort of maintain and keep in place the components that would have gone into closing those gaps, but are now simply lying on the ground rusting. Talk a little bit about what's happening there and how this outrage might be stopped.
Well, that part was definitely not mentioned during the campaign when Biden and all of his people were running around swearing that they were going to halt construction on the wall first thing, which is what they did. I was there the day they halted construction on the wall and saw acres and acres and acres of panels that were stacked 15 feet high and all of the equipment out there. I watched, I saw it, and I knew immediately that this was just going to be a problem. How, what are you going to do with all of this material out there? And now we know it's just going to be a drain on the public treasury for a long, long time. They are going to have to be paying for this for years before they finally, figure out a way to dispose of all this stuff. It was stupid. It was policy without any sort of planning. It was knee jerk, response to the base, the Democratic left part of the base. But you should see it, Frank. I mean, there's some video out there. I mean, just acres and acres and in places all along the southern border with equipment and material just sitting out there rotting.
Wow. Ready to go. Ready to be put into place in places where it's urgently needed. And we are paying through the nose for it not to be put into place and, as you say, deteriorating in the process. Todd Bensman, wow, this is a grim picture, as has been your reporting for some time, but it's desperately needed, and we appreciate the clarity that you bring to all of this. And I know you'll keep up the great work you do at CIS.org. Follow Todd there, as I do. And also check out his terrific book, America's Covert Border War. Come back to us again soon if you would, Todd. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we will speak with David Wormser about Middle East policy. Messes on our hands in that quarter as well. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's been said that conservatives are liberals who have been mugged by reality. Today, millions of Americans of all political stripes have undergone a similar transformation in the wake of the pandemic spawned when the Chinese Communist Party mugged us and the world with its deadly engineered virus. A new study by our Committee on the Present Danger, China, documents that far from a purportedly benign trading partner, the CCP is our mortal enemy. Entitled China's Dream, The World's Nightmare, this report exposes the ominous progress Beijing's colonial Belt and Road Initiative is making towards dominating and ultimately enslaving at least 140 nations all over the planet. Read the report at captivenations.org, then watch our webinar from 4:30 to 5:30 Eastern Time today, which will discuss the implications of this totalitarian imperial program and what we must do to defeat it. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're visiting for this block with our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Dr. David Wormser. He is a senior fellow and director of the Center's very important project on global anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel relationship, which is now nestled in an important new program on the Middle East and North Africa, headed up by Dr. Victoria Coates, former Deputy National Security Advisor to President Trump. David Wormser was in previous incarnations an advisor to then Vice President Dick Cheney, and he has served as an advisor as well to former Ambassador John Bolton, and as a naval intelligence officer. He's a man of many parts, and we're always delighted to have him here on Secure Freedom Radio. David, welcome back.
Well, thanks. It's always an honor, Frank. Always an honor.
Let me ask you first, David, about Iran. There are once again protests taking place in which the people of Iran have once again, quite courageously, taken to the streets to denounce the regime that has oppressed them for so long and increasingly threatens the rest of us. Talk a little bit about the nature of these protests, what's inspiring them, how widespread they are, and what is the Biden team doing, if anything, about it?
Well, sure, Frank. First of all, the protests are, I'd say they're a different character, but we've seen similar protests over the last year or two, except these are much more serious, where common people in Iran, not various sectors of society that are trying to protest their relationship with the government. Let's say truckers are so getting better deals. That's not the case right now. What you have right now are people who are completely desperate because literally they have no water. We see pictures of people leaning over in puddles, drinking puddles, because there's a complete, the government has broken down in terms of providing water. So this
is amidst a terrible drought in the country, as I understand it.
This is a terrible drought in the country, but already without the drought, they so mismanaged their water structure that rivers have dried up, completely dried up. And when environmentalists, the few environmentalists that Iran even allowed to have, started raising an alarm about this internationally and saying that we're running out of water here because of mismanagement, all those environmentalists were called political prisoners, arrested, and many have never been seen of since. So, you know, you have the Iranian government across the board, whether it's electricity, whether it's water, whether it's roads, whether it's anything really, they you see a crumbling of the system. And it's not because of sanctions, it's because of mismanagement and corruption. The Iranian government now, the prime currency is corruption. So it's all breaking down. And common people are out on the streets in despair, demanding the most minimal things like water. It started first in the driest part of the country, which is the southwest, which is the Arab part, Ahvaz area. But now it's spread all over the country. You have demonstrations in Tabriz, which is the Azeri part, way up in the northeast. I mean, northwest. You've had demonstrations in the center of the country, which is the heart of the Persian area. So this is a broad
in Tehran itself, as I understand it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you have a broad-based revolt that is popular, not one sector or another. We're talking cross-sector, popular, common folk.
Everybody's thirsty.
Demonstrating out of, yeah. So this is a very grave threat to the regime. The other thing is what they're chanting is no longer, you know, we want vaccines or we want water or we want this. They are going right for the jugular and they're demonstrating and saying death to Khamenei, death to the Ayatollahs. This is the first time we've seen such a brazen assault on the very existence of the regime by the Iranian people. So clearly,
and what does that
have a threat to the regime
mean in terms of U.S. policy towards the people of Iran and towards their oppressors in the mullahocracy, David Wormser?
When these regimes fall, the central indicator of it is that the elites lose the will to shoot. And they lose the will because they're not sure they're going to win, so they don't want to be held accountable for what happens afterwards. So if the confidence of the regime is broken with the idea that there might be a different result than the regime surviving, you will see a cascade of defectors who suddenly discover that they've always been with the opposition. So that's how these regimes fall, and people smell weakness in those systems that are so repressive. So,
and you know, it can happen very quickly,
can't
it? In some instances,
it can happen extremely quickly. It happens suddenly, in fact. But it depends on the United States to some extent. If the United States signals the Iranian people that we think, in the long term, they will survive, then that's a dampening, a dousing type of policy toward the energy that's on the street right now in Iran trying to overthrow the government. So it really
and this
is
isn't
in our hands
a hypothetical. This is something we actually witnessed not so long ago when the Obama administration was pursuing a similar policy to that of the Biden team, namely that it was all about getting some kind of deal with Iran on its nuclear weapons program. And Barack Obama very explicitly sort of disavowed the so-called Green Revolution at the time, as I recall, David, to signal his support for the regime. And yes, that clearly had the effect of undermining popular resistance at that time. So this is what we might anticipate would happen again in the present moment?
Or is already happening. I would note that deafening silence of this administration on demonstrations in Iran. It took them a week to say something about the demonstrations in Cuba. And when they did, it was only President Biden. And the words were good, but there was no action for follow-up. And his administration has been silent again ever since, while some of his closest allies are actually out there supporting the communist regime and towing their propaganda line that it's all because of U.S. sanctions. So the Iran is even worse. We haven't said a word about it. We haven't said a word about Iran's key ally, Hezbollah, and the situation in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is beginning to face the same sort of challenge in Lebanon that they are in, that the regime is facing in Iran itself. So this silence is being read regionally as American acquiescence in the survival of the Iranian regime and Hezbollah.
Well, not even acquiescence, perhaps. It may be its support for the regime, its opposition, in other words, to those in, you know, Iran itself or in Lebanon, who are yearning for freedom from the oppression of these theocracies. Talk a little bit more about Lebanon. I've heard the most dire of things about what's happening in that country, David, not least to Christians who are being terribly persecuted, the immigrants who fled from Syria, what's happening to them. And more broadly, what's happening to the fabric of that country, once one of the crown jewels of the region?
Yeah, what's happening is that after the huge explosion in Beirut last year, where what's clearly a Hezbollah stash of ammonium nitrate, which is the primary material for building bombs, when that huge stash exploded and destroyed the center of Beirut with what was essentially the force of a small nuclear device, there was a brief moment where all Lebanese, and by this I mean even Shiites, thought, that's it. We've had enough with Hezbollah. We've had enough of paying the price of being a puppet of Hezbollah. And they all unified, took to the streets. But again, there was this bizarre Western policy of trying to get a better behavior by the Lebanese government without challenging the very structure of the Lebanese government, which was nothing more than a Hezbollah puppet government or Iranian puppet government. So we keep wanting the same people, but different policies, not realizing that the only answer in Lebanon was a new crowd of people and a new arrangement. And so what's happened over the last year since then, it's almost exactly a year. It was, I believe, early August when the bomb material exploded. We have seen nothing in terms of real reform. Instead, the Iranians have essentially gutted the banking structure of Lebanon. They've taken it over and they've sucked out of it all reserves and all money. So Lebanon has essentially been a big raid by the Iranian government for currency, reserves, and money laundering, as well as drug trafficking and counterfeiting. So Lebanon is now totally impoverished. It's falling apart. Basic structures of function of society are crumbling in front of us, from banking to food distribution. If you want food now, you need to go to a Hezbollah-run store to get it. You're not going to get that food unless you have a ration card that Hezbollah gives you. So you therefore have to be loyal.
Right, which is not a happy prospect for the Christian population or for people of other stripes who simply don't want to bend the knee to Hezbollah.
Exactly. And they're fleeing. So what is Hezbollah doing in Iran? The Christians who are fleeing, they're seizing their houses and they're giving it to their Shiite Hezbollah operatives, some of which come from Iraq. So it's a very aggressive policy in Lebanon to utterly destroy the fabric of that country.
Yeah, and most especially the Christian population. Interestingly, David, just back on the explosion, I was told the other day that the government of Lebanon had been repeatedly warned by the Israelis that an explosion like this was going to happen, given the nature of that stockpile in a densely populated area around the port, and that the consequences would be disproportionately borne by the Christian population was preordained because that was the neighborhood that was adjacent to this, what you call sort of small thermonuclear explosive equivalent. So is the object of Hezbollah's current policy to not simply redistribute the wealth of Christians, but to remove them altogether from the Lebanese population, would you say, one way or the other?
Yeah, it's to drive them out. I mean, it's no accident that Hezbollah puts these dangerous depots in the middle of places where if something goes very wrong, Christians will pay the price, not their operatives. Secondly, it's a shield. It's basically they are now using the Christians and others as human shields. So Hezbollah is quite brazen in its behavior in this regard. And one can only conclude from that they'd be happier to get rid of the ethnic minorities that they can't control. And so their policy is definitely that. And the results are indicative. The flight from Lebanon of Christians and even Sunnis is significant.
This is a pretty grim picture of one part of the region. The Jordanian king was in town last week, David, and I didn't see much of what came of his visit or what prompted it, for that matter. Is Jordan in similar straits, would you say, or could it find itself in them shortly?
It could find itself in them shortly, and I think there's been a tremendous mismanagement by the king. His economy is in very bad shape. He doesn't have his own oil or gas. He relies on a good bit of it from Israel right now. Water, the Israelis give him a lot of water. The Israelis actually 2 weeks ago announced that they would up by a couple million cubic feet the amount of water they distribute to Jordan from their own aquifer in the Sea of Galilee. So again, you're seeing similar breakdowns in Jordan. There, it's partly mismanagement, but it's also partly that Jordan has its own limitations in many ways. Where I think the king has really made a big mistake is that the essence of Jordan is a Hashemite monarchy. And by that, I mean the Hashemites are tribes from southern Iraq, southern Jordan and northern Saudi Arabia, including Mecca and Medina. Those tribes are very joined. It's a very integrated tribal structure. And what happens in Jordan affects northern Saudi Arabia as well. And the Jordanian king, his primary role has always been to maintain the stability that comes with a state anchored to those tribes. This king seems to think that his stability is anchored to championing the Palestinian cause. And it's true that the majority of Jordanians are Palestinians. Quite a large majority, maybe 60 to 70%, are Palestinians. And from a human rights perspective, I can see this, but it isn't the point of Jordan. Jordan's point was to use the stable Hashemite structure to help manage the Palestinian issue. What the king is now doing is going from managing it to championing it. And his vehicle for championing it is the old PA, the Palestinian Authority structure, which the United States wants to revive so that it can have a renewed Oslo peace process to shift American policy back from the one that was under Trump, which was to go for the Abraham Accords, namely to take the powerful, large Arab countries and bring them into a state of peace with Israel and form a strategic bloc that then helps carry the water for the United States. This policy of the Biden administration is to take us back 5 years and go back to these eternal peace processes that lead to only greater rounds of violence. And the king sees himself as the advocate, as the champion for the Americans, for the revival of that process. And then he essentially says, my stability is dependent on this. And the Israelis and the Americans feel that because his stability is held hostage to progress on the peace process, this then brings tremendous pressure to bear on the Israelis to pay for this peace process through payments of their own flesh, essentially.
David, this is a subject to which we have to return on another occasion soon. I think it's a dynamic in a region that has been volatile for so long and seems to be poised to revert in ways that will prove very dangerous to our friends and interests there, and perhaps to us as well. So again, your clarity on these points is always appreciated, David. I think, like me, you, I'm sure, hope you're wrong about some of these prognoses, but I'm afraid you're right, and we need to be clear-eyed about them. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Reggie Littlejohn, the Women's Rights Without Frontier, about a whole host of issues of vital importance out in China and more, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of my favorite people, Reggie Littlejohn, the founder and president of a terrific organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers, an organization that under her leadership has really become preeminent in the space of championing the rights, particularly of the unborn in China, where millions and millions and millions of babies are well, subjected to infanticide. Indeed, there's some 400 million such deaths that have been taken credit for by the Chinese Communist Party, amazingly, over these many years. Reggie is a leader on so many fronts, and we're going to talk about some of her projects, notably those that she pursues, as well as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. It's always good to have her. Reggie, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let me start with a topic that you have taken point on, to your great credit. We co-sponsored it with your organization, Save the Persecuted Christians, Committee on the Present Danger of China, and so on. But talk about this phenomenon of vaccine passports. We're hearing more and more. Indeed, I believe that the Biden administration has just announced that it is going to require that employees of the Veterans Administration all have to be vaccinated. What's afoot here, and what are the implications, Reggie?
Well, we oppose mandatory vaccines, but also we oppose the vaccine passport. That's our focus. So we're not anti-vaxxers. We're not saying that you shouldn't have the vaccine. You know, some people probably should have the vaccine who are in high risk. You know, their health is at high risk. But what we oppose is a digital passport that you have to show to your vaccine status on. And the reason for that is that these digital passports are not like just sort of the innocuous digital equivalent of the vaccine yellow card that we're all familiar with from international travel. Rather, they use the same platform as China's social credit system, which means that all this functionality can be attached to them within a matter of hours, according to tech experts. So what's the functionality I'm talking about? The China social credit system, on people's phones, they have geolocation, you know, facial recognition. It is connected to your entire spending history, your social media posts, your health history, your credit cards, your bank accounts. So in China, which is moving to a cashless society, what they do is they give a person a total score of really basically what amounts to how reliable of a communist they are. And if you have a high score, you can lead what looks like a normal life. And if you, but you're not free, because if you post something on social media that criticizes Xi Jinping or says, you know, anything about Tibet or whatever, then your score will plummet. So if your score plummets, then you will find, you can lose your job. You can lose your house. You will not be able to borrow money to buy a house. Your kids will not be able to go to the schools you want them to go to. You will not be able to travel. If you get a really low score, like if you are an actual dissident, they can number one, cut off your access to your bank account and to your credit cards so that you have no ability even to buy food, and they can disappear you. We don't want this in the United States.
We certainly don't. And yet it does seem as though we're perilously close, as the insistence of both political figures and healthcare professionals and the media intensifies, that those who are not vaccinated are somehow endangering the rest of the population, and everybody must be compelled to get vaccinated. And if they don't, there must be certain penalties associated with failure to do so. And Reggie, I think your concerns about the social credit system of China, which are well grounded, when you see what this is doing to enable the most comprehensive forms of totalitarianism imaginable, and that the Chinese Communist Party, of course, is not content to simply inflict it upon their own people and those that they've enslaved in the captive nations of China, but that they're trying to export elsewhere around the world, including here. This makes for a very worrying set of prospects, not least of which is that the Biden administration may well decide that it wants to not only have these vaccine mandates imposed on government personnel, but on others, school children or workers in various private entities, but that it wants to begin using the kinds of technologies and techniques that go into the social credit system for controlling our population as well. A frightening prospect, and we thank you again. People can find out more about this project, this danger, at the website of our initiative. Give us that website and specifically talk just quickly about the webinar that's there.
Yeah, the website is stopvaxpassports.org, and it's spelled stopvaxpassports.org. And so you can sign a petition to stop these vaccine passports. So please do that, and then we'll keep you updated. And we also had what I think is a magnificent and the authoritative webinar on the dangers of vaccine passports. And you can find that on that website. I really urge you to listen to that, because you will get the truth from a variety of perspectives, including a high-tech perspective on the dangers of these passports.
Amen. I was privileged to moderate that, and I agree with you. It was a terrific program, and your particular contribution to it was required viewing, as I say. Let me turn to one of your other projects, Reggie, again with the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and others of our friends, and that is to try, in the face of the continuing and it seems intensifying crimes against humanity of the Chinese Communist Party, to ensure that we do not legitimate this regime, let alone persuade it that it can engage in such behavior and all manner of other criminal activities, for that matter, with impunity. I saw that members of Congress have, on a bipartisan basis, called for the Genocide Games, as we've been calling them, the February Olympic Games next year in Beijing, to be moved. And I think if that does not happen to be boycotted, which is very much your position, there's a hearing today on the subject on Capitol Hill. As we speak, it's in prospect. As this program airs, it will have happened. But tell us a little bit about what the lay of the land is on all these fronts and why this is such an important issue, Reggie.
China has been officially designated as committing genocide against the Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities in Xinjiang through forced abortion, forced sterilization, systematic rape, interning people in what they call re-education centers and what activists call concentration camps, forced labor, executing prisoners of conscience to harvest their organs for transplant. Okay, that's what constitutes this genocide. And it is completely inappropriate for the world to honor them by allowing them to host the Olympic Games. We're trying to get the International Olympic Committee to move those games, or if they insist on keeping them in Beijing, that we need to not participate. So there was a hearing about this in May at which I testified, and that hearing concentrated on the atrocities that are happening. Today, the hearing is about the corporate sponsors of these games. And so these sponsors are being brought before Congress to explain why they're sponsoring these Olympics. And one of the questions is how they will manage the material and reputational risks of being associated with an Olympic Games held in the midst of a genocide. So I am thrilled that Congress is holding this hearing, and I can't wait to see what these witnesses have to say.
Me too. And again, I commend you for your leadership on this. Your testimony in that previous hearing was very powerful, Reggie Littlejohn. And I think particularly your point, which I hope will operate in today's hearing as well, namely that we actually have an obligation under the Genocide Convention to stand against the genocide and to punish the perpetrators of it. And this would be the antithesis of doing that, of course, and must not go forward. One other thing, when we had a rally recently on this issue at the foot of the Capitol, Reggie, one of our colleagues, Jason Jones, a filmmaker, I think he calls his outfit Movies to Movement, quite impressive national level athlete who competed representing our country internationally, I believe in a couple of martial arts fields that were not at the time Olympic events. But he has spoken at that rally about something that I think the athletes participating in the Olympics themselves should be mindful of, which is that the Chinese will use their DNA as part of the bioengineering that the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in to create, we know, super warriors, and I'm reasonably sure super athletes, and maybe a super population for that matter. Something that I would think most of these athletes would be horrified to contemplate. Talk a little bit about that and what other evidence there is that the Chinese are expropriating DNA for potentially very ominous purposes, maybe even biological warfare for that matter.
Thank you for asking me about that, Frank. So with respect to the athletes, the first thing I want to say is people say, oh, it's not fair to the athletes to boycott the game. Well, I'll tell you something else that is not fair to the athletes. It is not fair to the athletes, many or perhaps all of whom are horrified by what's going on in China. And it's not fair to force them to have to choose between their conscience, which says, I don't want to honor a regime that's committing genocide, and their athletic ambition. That is unfair. We need to move the game. Now, in terms of the dangers to the athletes and going over there, I remember in the 2008 games, there were athletes who did not participate in the 2008 in Beijing, did not participate for health reasons. Like, I'm not running a marathon in that horrible air because it could do permanent lung damage, right? I mean, there are people who withdrew for that reason. And in the 2022 games, I think that that the athletes need to be aware of other health reasons to not go there. Who's to say?
Look no further than the Tokyo games underway right now, which have been a complete debacle, in part because of COVID. No?
Right. But see, the Chinese Communist Party already either recklessly or deliberately infected the world with COVID-19. Who's to say that when they have this enormous international crowd that they might not, you know, release something else and everybody goes back to their host country? You know, so that's one thing. And then the other thing is, what if they require some kind of a blood test to compete? I mean, I wouldn't put it beyond them. I'm sure that they're absolutely lusting after the blood of those athletes because they can use it to do something they've already said they want to do, which is create super soldiers. Okay. So these athletes are the best specimens, you know, physical specimens in the world. Why would, you know, if they could have their DNA to create super soldiers? And also, these athletes are they're every race, every country, and they could use their DNA to try to create biological warfare, you know, weapons that will that will target certain populations. So, you know, so this is nothing that's not fair to the athletes. It's not fair to them to put them in a position where they could be forced to participate in such a nefarious and evil project.
I hope that this hearing today will be the death knell for this whole venture, and that the corporate sponsors will see that it is in their interest, as well as the national interest, as well as the athletes' interest, to pull the plug on the Beijing Genocide Games. And thank you for your leadership on that, Reggie. Let me turn quickly to one other issue that you have been helpful and supportive of. Our Committee on the Present Danger, China, Captive Nations Coalition yesterday released a new report entitled China's Dream, the World's Nightmare. And we're having a webinar today, again, as we speak. It's in Prospect. As you'll hear this, it has happened. I really want to commend to our listeners going to the website captivenations.org, both to see the report and to take aboard the information that will be imparted by that webinar. Reggie, your thoughts on the report and the importance of getting clarity about what the Chinese Communist Party is doing with its Belt and Road Initiative would be most welcome.
Oh, Frank, you know, I have read this report, and this is an absolutely groundbreaking and should be a game-changing report. And I just urge everyone to go on captivenations.org and read this report, because it exposes perhaps one of the most important ways that China is really the new colonialist. They are colonializing themselves throughout the world through this debt trap diplomacy, where they will lend money to build infrastructure to a poor nation that they know is not going to be able to pay them back. And then they have these terms hidden in the contracts that say things like, if you can't pay us back by a certain time, we own the infrastructure. And so then they're taking over infrastructure, natural resources, all over the world through this. And I think it's got to be illegal. I mean, anyway, we got to stop this.
Amen. Well, that's the point of this exercise, to figure out how to do that. And we've got some specific suggestions and policy prescriptions, as we call them, that we'll be talking about in the webinar today. Please check out the report. As Reggie says, I'm so appreciative of your laudatory comments, Reggie, because they come from somebody whose expertise I really respect, and I think our audience does as well. And I hope that that will impel them to check out captivenations.org. Reggie, come back to us again soon, if you would. It's so good to talk with you, and we appreciate so much your work on all of these fronts. I know you'll keep it up. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Affney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.